Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, I'm John Newland. No, this is not One Step Beyond.
Watch that step. Watch that step, Dale.
That first step's a doozy. No, I'm Dale Kay from Spook Show. And?
I'm Dave Baker from The Weirdest Really Bad Movie.
And you're listening to Eerie House Radio. Now, last night, we had a very, very fine episode of Suspense featuring the great Vincent Price and the equally as great, I think, Claude Rains.
Yes, very much so. He's a guy that just never really seemed to go down a whole lot. When it did, he turned to television for different types of roles. It was an interesting career the guy had.
Yeah, he, you know, being born in England, obviously, you know, he had the accent and whatnot. Came to the United States, although he did some stuff here, he didn't get his citizenship until 1939.
But he had become a naturalized citizen at that point, yes.
Yeah. And his movie career, oh man, I don't know where to start. Well, at the beginning is a good place, I guess. According to a couple of sources I looked at, he was in a 1920 silent film called Build by House, and then not in another film until really his signature role is Dr. Jack Griffin, also known as the Invisible Man, in 1933.
He went back, he was in the UK, and he was doing a lot of teaching at the time at the British Academy of Dramatic Arts. And actually, one of his students we've heard of over here, John Gielgud, who, amongst many of his roles on radio, played the role of Sherlock Holmes with Sir Ralph Richardson as Watson.
Do you mean the Sir John Gielgud?
He was a student of Claude Rains, as Claude was a teacher at the dramatic arts there.
Oh, wow.
Actually, it's amazed he made as many movies as it is that he didn't have time as many times as he was busy being married and divorced.
yeah, he didn't stay married long. In fact, one of his marriages was like less than a year, I think.
I think it was like 3 months. Yeah. They never knew each other. They didn't really know each other when they got married. And apparently he found out after they got married, she was quite the alcoholic. So that one lasted about 3 months long.
Wow.
Yeah.
I did not know, you know, throughout doing a little research, of course, for the show today, I either did not know or had forgotten that the great James Whale directed The Invisible Man.
Oh, okay.
And of course, that film had landmark special effects at the time. They were quite breakthrough, and there's still some things I don't think that are fully known how some of the effects were pulled off.
You know what's funny about that movie? Because in all of his time as an actor, and all the wonderful roles and films he was in, he never, ever attended a premiere. And the first time his daughter ever saw him in a film was in 1950, because he bought a little farm in Pennsylvania where he spent a lot of his time when he wasn't acting. And he took his daughter to see The Invisible Man from 1933 in a small theater in Pennsylvania. They sat back, and Rains told her all about the making of the film as it played. And I guess the other people in the theater weren't watching the movie. Rather, they were watching Rains explain to his daughter how he made the film.
Oh,
man, wouldn't that have been Vince, would that have not? You know, you get these movies with the actors or directors talking behind it sometimes, or, you know, can you imagine being in a theater with Claude Rains, turning around and Claude Rains is there explaining to his daughter exactly how they did everything?
That's something, boy. I'd give anything to be in that theater, huh? To be a fly on the wall. He did a lot of non-horror roles, too. I mean, he was in The Mystery of Edwin Drood, The Clairvoyant. He played Marley in Scrooge.
Of course, Casablanca. Casablanca. Wasn't that maybe either that and Invisible Man were probably his two best known film roles.
Yeah, he played a policeman, I think, in Casablanca.
Yeah.
And just like last night, in the hands of Mr. Ottermole. He was a constable in there, too.
Yeah.
That's true. One of my favorite roles of his, however, was from a little 1941 movie.
Even a man who is pure in heart and says his prayers by night may become a wolf when the wolf bane blooms and the autumn moon is bright.
Yeah, I'm talking about 1941, The Wolfman with Lon Chaney Jr.
Yes.
Claude plays his dad, Sir John Talbot.
Yeah.
And they were like titled, they were like a titled family. They had you know, a lot of the commoners looking up to the Talbot family at that time when Larry got bit. And I liked him as the father. It was a very hard role because at the end, of course, he beats the wolf at the time.
Yeah.
with a cane with a silver ending. and then horribly finds out it's his father.
It's a very hard role.
And we have someone here in Erie House with us.
Who could it be?
I don't know, but I sense royalty in the room.
You can't. You are familiar with the kingdom.
Welcome, your worshipfulness.
Well, I don't think that far. I don't think anybody would worship me. If they did, I think they should worship like a rock or dandelions or something like that.
I don't know about your portion of the world, but over here by Erie House, we it was like 75, I think, yesterday of a high.
Yeah.
And it's like 35 now or something.
I saw some snow flying. Did you see on your side of Lake Erie there's some snow there, Dale?
We had a couple flakes. We had a couple flakes in the Erie House swamp.
Well, it was 72 degrees in this afternoon, where I live in Maryland, and unfortunately it rained like cats and dogs. I know that because I stepped in a poodle.
Oh my! Where's the where's the rim shot when I need it?
Yeah.
No.
I promise I won't tell any crummy jokes like I did yesterday.
We don't get rim shots here. We get.
That's the reaction I usually get, so I'm used to that.
I used to get that one asking for a date, but I digress. We're talking about the storied, nice segue, huh? Storied career of Claude Rains, and I know that you, King, are a fan.
Oh, definitely. I was trying to look up some of his career, and it's,
I did not know that. I did not know in the same year that he made Casablanca that he was also opposite Bette Davis in Now Voyager, and also in 1942.
Yeah, I think he faced off against against Bette Davis three times in that decade. And I guess he held his own.
Yeah.
What other movies did he make?
Oh, gosh. He did a version of Phantom of the Opera in 1943 as Eric, you know, of the opera. He also played Caesar in an unfortunate underperforming film with Vivian Leigh called Caesar and Cleopatra, you know, the great story of Rome and Egypt at the time. And for some reason, it fizzled. It did not do well.
He was in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. He's actually nominated four times for Oscar for Best Supporting Actor and never once received it. That's surprising for some of the things we've seen.
I think
him
he
in.
Got a Tony in Broadway, though, didn't he?
He did. He got a Tony in Broadway for a dramatic role that he did there. But he never received an Oscar.
Well, even to get a nomination, I think is pretty good because, I mean, a lot of people win Oscars. I mean, you, what is there? There's like five nominees in each category. And the big controversy, you know, is like, well, how did that person get it when so-and-so definitely deserved it more, you know, in a lot of other people's opinions. But it's the Academy that votes, so.
I don't put a lot of stock in the Academy, okay? And one of my favorite rants about it is 1981, or the Academy Awards for the year 1981, so it'd probably be in 1982, when Chariots of Fire beat out Indiana Jones, or the original Raiders of the Lost Ark, okay? Now,
yeah.
Do you still have your Chariots of Fire action figures? Your Chariots of Fire lunchbox?
No. I still
have my 45, though, of the theme from Chariots of Fire, so.
Oh, and I have a very comical story. I told it once before here, perhaps in the old carnation of the show. When the Plastic Skull came out, the most recent one that took place in the 50s, with Indy being a bit older and, you know, it was somewhat disappointing for most Indiana Jones fans. But while we were waiting in the theater for it to play, I was going through this rant. I went with my two children. I was ranting about Chariots of Fire. And wouldn't you know that the music playing in the theater breaks out into Chariots of Fire, and I thought I was going to die right then and there.
Actually, I didn't think that last film was that bad. You know, I mean, the one he did before, you know, he jumps out of an airplane with nothing but a rubber raft. And people were talking how the last one was implausible. Give me a stinking break.
Yeah, that was that one I had trouble with, too. That was the one that took place in India. That was the second film. What was it called?
Like,
Indiana Jones.
The Temple of Doom?
A Temple of Doom, yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that
how
one,
many did he make?
There was a lot of non-credible adventures, I think, in that film and surviving the nuclear blast because he's in a lead-lined refrigerator and the Plastic Skull was a little stretch in the – but still entertaining. I mean, it was still a good adventure film.
Yes, yes. But –
I mean, I think there has to be a difference between, okay, this is immensely popular because – I mean, I know people that, I mean, quote things, and this is, you know, with all due respect, you know, oh, this is in the Adam Sandler movie. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I don't think that anything he's made is worthy of even a, you know, even being considered by the Academy. You know, I mean, it's just junk comedy. You know, I mean, jokes about body parts or bodily function. I'm sorry, that's for, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, those things, I suppose they have their place, I agree, but yeah, it, as far as the Academy, no, I don't think that's, no.
What did you think of the 1960 version that he was in The Lost World?
I'm glad you brought that up. He really was the saving grace of the film. Being a fan of Ray Harryhausen, I would have expected him to have been asked to do the effects, and unfortunately they used a lot of lizards with fins glued on them. But
yeah.
It's still he made the film watchable as Professor Challenger.
Yes.
And I've only recently rewatched it for the first time in many years.
I need to do that, too. I've not seen it for probably at least a decade. I need to sit down and watch that again.
Yeah, it might be somewhere on one of the Roku channels, and it's quite entertaining. It's fun. I have a lot of fun with films like The Journey to the Center of the Earth, a lot due to Bernard Herrmann's wonderful soundtrack. But
right.
Much like Claude Rains, you had a great seasoned actor with a very distinctive voice in James Mason in the film.
Yes.
Well, he had one of those distinctive voices. I mean, he's someone you listen to him recite the telephone book or a recipe book or something like that.
Yeah. I wasn't aware until doing some research today how much television Claude Rains was in. He was in a show called The Reporter, an episode of Dr. Kildare, The DuPont Show of the Week, Rawhide. Yeah.
He was on five episodes of Alfred Hitchcock Presents. Five separate episodes of that. I thought that was interesting. Not a lot of people got a lot of callbacks.
Did Hitchcock ever do any radio? Did we talk about that last week or the week before?
A lot of his stuff was adapted for radio. Hitchcock stuff was adapted for radio. And even Cary Grant, who was in Shadow of Doubt on radio, adaption was tremendous. But the only one he actually directed would have been that very, very first episode of Suspense that was on 2 years before the series kicked in.
Okay.
Of The Lodger. But that was the only actual radio that Hitchcock directed.
Because by that time, and he was, I mean, absolutely world famous in films, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah, because he'd done well in England and was over here putting his own stamp in our films over here. Another guy that never, you know, there's another argument against your Oscar, because there's another guy never, ever got a Best Director. Can you imagine the quality of films that he made? And he never got a Best Director.
Yeah, and he was making them for a long time, from the early 30s all the way through the 60s.
Yeah.
To the end of the 60s.
And the only one that was really not worth watching would have been his last one, Family Plot.
I enjoyed that film.
Did
first
really?
Of all, I love Bruce. Yeah, I love Bruce Dern.
I have no problem with Bruce Dern, but as a Hitchcock film, think of it, if you're thinking of it as a Hitchcock film, it just wasn't there.
No, you're right. It wasn't his usual fare. It wasn't anywhere near as suspenseful or exciting, but it was a fun romp with Karen Black in it, too.
Yeah,
whom I love. I have a crush on Karen Black.
And why not? That's guy played everything from an angel.
I have a crush on Lillian
Gish.
That's okay.
Hmm?
I said I have an immense crush. Actually, two of them. One of which we talked about. Her name has come up so much in the old timey radio shows. Agnes Moorehead.
Yeah,
I mean, even in Bewitched.
Known as the voice that when Rod Serling gave her a script for Twilight Zone that she was in, I think it was called, The Invaders? She read through it and then asked him, what's my part? Because she was known as the voice because of all the work that she'd done on radio. And she'd worked with Orson Welles in the Mercury Theater of the air, but also in the movies for him and a few other movies. But, she didn't say a word in The Invaders, Twilight Zone episode.
Yeah, she was very terrified, but not a bit of dialogue.
Well, I mean, given the opportunity, let's see, in Bewitched, you had Gladys Kravitz. Maybe not. what was it, Samantha? Yeah, okay. Agnes Moorehead. Oh, yeah, baby. What are you doing tonight?
It kind of shows the difference between his age and ours, doesn't it, Dale?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Do you remember then, King, the Mellow Tunes from 1960 with David and Goliath? Claude Rains was the narrator of that show.
Mellow Tunes. I don't recall that at all.
Basically, there were cartoons that were narrated and kind of animated around the narration, and that's one of two things. I looked on his list. That's only one of two things that I noticed that's in public domain that's available.
Yeah.
These were cartoons, you said?
Yeah.
I've been looking for a reason to use the other one, The Clairvoyant, all from 1935, also a very good film. And you can catch that on the internet, on the archive.org. If you haven't seen it, it is a tremendous, a very good film.
The Clairvoyant.
The Clairvoyant.
Yes, he plays a character named Maximus.
It's called something else on Internet Archive because they took it off the re-release. Clairvoyant was the original title for it, where he was one of these guys that can foretell the future, and it kind of caused him to go crazy, kind of went crazy in The Invisible Man.
Yeah. It was kind of fun to watch him slowly go mad in that film.
Yeah.
He was
actually,
having fun first, but...
That's a really good point. When you look at, suppose you had, I'm sorry, this gets off into science fiction again. Gee, how did that happen? if you look at the talents that supposedly telepaths, telekinesisists, where you can, what's that? I think that's where you can make things
move.
Move
stuff, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All the kind of things like that. But clairvoyance, if you know what's going to happen, I mean, it could be bad things happening. And depending on how far you look, you might say, oh, my God, the world ends next week, you know?
Yeah, I'm not sure I'd want to know those things.
Yeah.
And you could go slowly mad instead. I want to hear some of the roles that Claude Rains has turned down.
Sure.
Or wasn't available to. Either wasn't available or he just out and out turned it down. Dr. Gogol in Mad Love from 1935.
Oh, wow. Peter Lorre's role.
Dr. Pretorius in Bride of Frankenstein, 1935.
Oh, my.
Frollo or Quasimodo in The Hunchback of Notre Dame.
The one that Lofton played?
Yes. Or Frollo, but also the Quasimodo role, which is what Lofton played.
I see.
Played.
What you mean. Yeah. The other
character. So there were two roles he was offered in there. Wolf von Frankenstein in Son of Frankenstein. And that went to Basil Rathbone, right?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Yes, he was Wolf.
Professor Higgins in Pygmalion. In 1938, Dr. Doolittle in My Fair Lady, which would have been the musical version of Pygmalion, but not as Professor Higgins, but as the doctor friend of his. In 1964, he Klaatu in The Day the Earth Stood Still.
Oh my
no
goodness!
Wow.
Now Klaatu didn't say anything, did he?
That one's hard to picture because I can't see anybody but Michael Rennie as Klaatu.
Michael, I'm sure
he would have done a great job. The guy was.
They're saying
actor.
How that kind of changed his career path. Duke Lore in Adventures of Don Juan and Henry Potter in It's a Wonderful Life, 1946.
Was he not also? I thought people were mentioning him in Psycho as a possible getting a part in Psycho. Or am I wrong? I'm not. Seems to me somewhere in the discussion that either he turned it down or they considered him and then went with somebody else. I think it was the police detective that eventually solved the case. I don't remember. It just dawned on me when you were talking about him that, when I think of, people that, it's like, okay, this guy did the role, but, this guy I think would have been even better had they chosen him.
I don't know if he would have done that because he did do one film for Hitchcock, and Alfred Hitchcock suggested he was in Notorious for Alfred Hitchcock with Ingrid Bergman, and
yes.
Hitchcock suggested Rains wear platform in his shoes as Bergman was very tall and though embarrassed he agreed to it. And one day when Rains was talking to Bergman, Hitchcock came by, lifted Rains' pant leg, revealing the platforms, commenting, "The shame of Rains." Now, do you think that Claude Rains would have ever wanted to work with Hitchcock again after that? If it was discussed, it wasn't something that I'm sure Claude Rains thought.
I've seen photos of those, and they almost look like those 70s platform shoes.
Well, they used to stick out. What was it, Alan Ladd? They used to have to stick him on top of a box in the close-ups. You know, where he had to kiss some girl or something. Because, I mean, he was like 4 or 5, 6 inches shorter than, you know, some of the leading ladies. And it would look kind of weird for him to be, you know, pulling her head down, you know, far enough for him to, you know, to stick one on her cheek.
Yeah. Yeah, Claude Rains was not particularly tall either. And it showed in The Wolfman because Lon Chaney was a big man. You know, Junior was a big man. And it showed. It's like, really? That's your father? You better have a talk with your mom, buddy.
Yeah. A little hanky-panky?
I like the way, much like Laurie, when Claude Rains goes mad in a film, it's a slow burn. Particularly like in The Invisible Man, at first he's kind of having fun with his madness before he actually became dangerous.
Yeah, I like the way that I like the way the Guard of the Ghoul builds up Peter Lorre burn. You know,
yeah,
he's slowly, and then he gets more excited until he, I guess, you know, that kind of thing. Right?
I know,
right? The places where he did was quite a bit like that.
Quick shout out to the chat, Evil Annie Repper. Welcome back. Fogsbane is with us. Guest 808 and guest 812.
Wow.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Call in. Join us. What the heck? It's 646-378-0264. Dial or press your buttons carefully.
Even if you're invisible, you can listen to the show.
That's right.
Well, that's a good point, too. Just, I mean, suppose, hey, now I'm invisible. Well, now you got a problem crossing the streets because people can't see you. How do you go into a restaurant because the waiter ain't going to see you? There's an interesting science fiction story where they don't actually make the person invisible, but they put an actual stamp on their head, and this person is considered invisible. And if you went into a restaurant, say, and started, you know, eating off of your plate or went back in the kitchen and started grabbing food, it might be that the guy has a pot of hot water, you know, and throws it at you and can claim, well, I didn't actually see him. Gee, I mean, I slipped and, I scalded the guy, but I didn't see him. But it was an interesting point at the end of his sentence. When they take the emblem off of your forehead, a guy comes up to him who has, you know, was in the same plight, and you can't, I mean, the idea was, is you can't have any contact, you can't talk to anybody with that emblem, and he shows his humanity in, you know, shaking the guy's hand, hugging him, and trying to tell him that, look, you'll get through it, and he goes back and gets arrested again. But that's, you know,
Hold on one second. Mrs. K is calling.
What? What, honey? The Invisible Man is here? Tell him I can't see him right now.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Good old line from the, Spike Jones used that as well in his Spike Jones and Hi-Fi. And Paul Frees, was Dracula in that. He gave that line. Wonderful, wonderful line. Yes.
Thank you.
He'll be here all week, folks, for better or worse.
You know, interesting, you said how the Caesar and Cleopatra really didn't do well, Dale.
Yeah.
In his obituary, the New York Times claimed that Rains was first British stage and film star to earn $1 million for a single film, and that was in Caesar and Cleopatra in 19...
And Vivian Leigh was, to me, Vivian Leigh in that film was just as lovely as Elizabeth Taylor years later.
So the studio must have really believed in it to be willing to pay him $1 million for a single film in 1940.
What year was it?
1945. We were just coming out of World War II.
And they gave him $1 million? Wow.
Yep, to play Caesar.
Who else got, what other kind of people got money in that, big money? Anybody?
I would imagine Vivian Leigh, but he was probably the big pull at that time. So
yeah, well, maybe it wasn't marketed well or something, but for whatever reason, it just didn't do well. It was he was in a couple of those biblical type stories. I know one of the last films he was in was The Greatest Story Ever Told. He played Herod, King Herod.
Yeah.
That dirty King Herod. but to his credit, he can play a character that maybe you don't like so much. You know, you kind of felt sorry for Dr. Griffith and The Invisible Man. You really felt sorry for... Sir John Talbot for, you know, having to really put down his own son in the Wolfman, but you didn't feel too sorry for him as King Herod. He was
of other unpopular characters that, a well-beloved actor or actress, you know, would come in and, oh, who was the one, she did a film where she, Betty Davis, I think, or somebody like that, where it was an autobiography or a biography, and she hit her kids with hangers or something like that.
Joan Crawford, maybe?
Maybe that was it, yeah. I mean, that's, you know, when you go through that, that's a tough role.
Joan Crawford wasn't a real nice person. Matter of fact, crossing Joan Crawford into Claude Rains, Joan Crawford invited his daughter, Jennifer, to Christina's birthday party. She told Jennifer's mother, Claude's wife, that Jennifer could wear jeans. When they showed up at the party, she was the only one that wasn't all dressed up. When Christina introduced Jennifer to her mother, Crawford said to Jennifer, "It was very nice to meet you, and now you may leave." Jennifer was all shown Christine's extensive doll collection, which Christina explained to her that no one was ever allowed to touch or play with. Jennifer never returned to the Crawford home for some reason.
Because Joan Crawford freaked her out.
Yep.
I'm sure there was a lot of eccentric people in Hollywood. You mentioned some weeks ago, The Adventures of Robin Hood, which is one of my all-time favorite movies. And Basil Rathbone was a very accomplished swordsman. I mean, if it had been a real fight, he would have made mincemeat out of Errol Flynn.
Errol Flynn, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he actually...
I mean, Errol Flynn was not great with a sword, but Basil Rathbone was. I mean, he could...
Yeah, he had to lose his battles.
Yeah.
The only one he was allowed to win was in Tybalt in Romeo and Juliet.
Yeah,
we
covered
yeah.
some of that when we talked about Basil Rathbone. What was that, last week?
Yes.
He was very good. I like, you mentioned earlier The Lost World. Even though he was a protagonist, Professor Challenger, he was absolutely irascible, especially at the beginning.
That's part of the thing I loved about it so much.
Yeah. And you got the feel for it in the original silent version, but Claude Rains really brought that character to life and demonstrated how obnoxious he could be.
Yep. Usually he was. Well, you know, he was in a heck of a lot of A movies, and he leapt kind of back and forth between leads, and but he wasn't afraid, as long as it was a good movie, he wasn't afraid to become a good supporting actor in things. And much like in the suspense that we heard last night, where basically he had the lead and Vincent Price stood back and was a supporting actor, but he sure did his part. You know, it's an amazing radio play. If you haven't heard it yet, go to the archives, everybody, and listen to that wonderful episode of Suspense that we shared last night.
Yeah, or better yet, just come go into our archives and listen to us host it. That'd be even more fun.
Well, you get Gar in the. If you do that, you get Gar for free.
Yep. There you go. And Gar's not with us today. I don't mean deceased. He's just not here.
Well, Gar spends 2 hours in makeup. He does a four-hour live show.
He was feeling poorly and said he probably wasn't going to make it here today. But someone's here. Welcome to Erie House.
4 hour
live. Bazoo! What was that?
Gesundheit.
Did he say Bazo?
Well, at least he didn't say basil. It's not a herb.
Oh, Bazo.
Yeah.
Basil.
Maybe
Basil.
That was him. Maybe that was all he could muster with his cold.
I thought I needed to say Gesundheit after that.
That's the funniest call I've ever gotten. Basil! To laugh a minute.
And since you did bring up The Adventures of Robin Hood, Claude Rains was also in that. He was French John in The Adventures of Robin Hood from 1938, along with Basil Rathbone and Errol Flynn.
Yep. I know. Some of these movies you brought up earlier, like Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, I was rather surprised. And so basically, he got to work with a lot of the greats. Hitchcock, Frank Capra directed that film. He worked with James Whale. I mean, he worked with a lot of the really great directors.
Great directors and great actors. You know, just think of all these shows that he was in and who he was going against.
Yeah, he was even in Lawrence of Arabia, which, you know, that was a star-packed film. Peter O'Toole, Alec Guinness, Omar Sharif, Anthony Quinn.
What part did he play in that movie?
Mr. Dryden. Yeah.
Geez, I don't have any recollection of that at all. And that was a movie that I've seen at least a couple of times. I mean, you're right. That was a four-hour film, I think. I first saw that when it came out. And, which is what, 63?
It was so long they had two intermissions.
Yeah, the one I saw only had one. And
kidding.
I mean, I was so young. My folks, you know, drove me down, dumped me off at the theater, and they came back. I think it was like 11 o'clock at night. I had never been up that late in my life before. And but it was I thought it was a fantastic film.
Yeah.
So many
people, Dana Andrews and Lloyd Bridges in a film called Sealed Cargo. He worked with Robert Mitchum and Maureen O'Sullivan in Where Danger Lies. Glenn Ford, Cedric Hardwick and Lloyd Bridges in The White Tower. Burt Lancaster, Paul Henreid, and Peter Lorre in Rope of Sand.
Yeah.
Betty Davis in Deception. Cary Grant and Ingrid Bergman, as we mentioned earlier, with the Hitchcock-directed Notorious. I mean, he's worked with a lot of really big-time folks. Humphrey Bogart. Ingrid Bergman, Conrad Veidt, Peter Lorre.
No.
With Casablanca had a lot of greats.
Yeah, I'm telling you, a lot of. Well, that was an all-time classic film. That was
Ida
one of those
Lupino
films
in Moontide.
That was one of those films you could never colorize. It was just filmed so perfectly for black and white. I know that one scene when they're in the room and the ceiling fan is casting these different shadows as it's slowly going around. That's something you cannot get in color. That's one, you know, of all the ones that black and white was shown a lot of times because it was just out and out cheaper. But there are some films that were actually filmed for black and white. You can't take a lot of the Twilight Zones and colorize them because they knew how to use the lighting and shadowing to the best effect. You can't colorize that. Just and Casablanca is one of those ones you never can touch. Now, I never understood what Jimmy Stewart was so upset about colorizing It's a Wonderful Life, because that didn't hurt it. But you couldn't colorize Orson Welles' Citizen Kane. You know, there's some you can, which are most of them. You know, when people were telling me that they were colorizing all the Laurel and Hardy films, I said, well, that's great. A generation will watch them that wouldn't have watched them in black and white. But they were filmed that way because it was cheaper. They filmed The Three Stooges in black and white because it was cheaper. They filmed Abbott Costello in black and white because it was cheaper. Not because it was all that necessary, but because it was cheaper.
Right. I mean, that's a good point, Dave. How would you take, well, I had to, just because it's one of my favorite films, Psycho. You could not possibly colorize that. It would be terrible. Just the shots of the... you know, the house, you know, the shots from way down below looking up at the house.
Yeah.
I mean, how could you, I mean, it would be, I'm sorry, that would be desecration if they ever, and I would absolutely never watch a colorized version of that. Although I will say this, you mentioned the Three Stooges, and as a Three Stooges fanatic, I have every single episode, all the movies, even though a lot of them, you know, were not that great. That some of the colorized episodes, they do come off pretty good. I mean, they're in a lot of ways, I guess, they have to guess and say, okay, it looks like he had a brown suit on, so we'll make it a brown suit. But
yeah,
I look at him now as a, well, I'm sorry, as a purist, a Three Stooges purist, and I say to myself, you know what? Those aren't bad. Those are very watchable.
It really was only filmed in black and white because it was cheaper. Now, I thought it was interesting, last Christmas time, CBS colorized a couple episodes of the Dick Van Dyke Show. And I watched them, and I said, well, it really didn't do anything to add it, but it didn't hurt anything. Sometimes when you see it, you just look at it and say, wow. And to me, you know, because the show was so well done, it didn't bother me that it wasn't in color, but it didn't hurt anything being in color. But it didn't, to me, it didn't add that much to it.
No, I think
I didn't have a problem with it.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
No, I just think your point earlier about how, in particular, some films really worked the medium they had. When they had black and white, they worked the coloring. Well, I should say the shading, since it's black and white. They worked
right.
The shade. They worked the shadows, and they won't work in color. Absolutely. But to your point, King, I am also a huge Three Stooges fan. Should probably do a Stooges show here sometime. I own Mo Howard's book. You know, his autobiography. I've read some other informative books. I love all their stuff. And I didn't find the color ones unwatchable. I see them more as kind of a novelty. I prefer the black and white original format. But, yeah, it doesn't really ruin it when it's in color.
I mean, I don't think it makes them better. But mm-hmm. I mean, they're watchable, and it's just, and it's it's sort of interesting to see.
Now, let me ask you this, guys: if they had made all three Stooges shorts in color instead of black and white, would you feel that you missed anything?
Probably not, because I
no,
watched
probably
them
not.
When I was five. I mean,
it was cheaper.
I was like,
that's
yeah.
why they did everything on the cheap in those movies. You know?
Well, Harry Cohn, who was the head of the studio, who, I think a lot of people didn't like. He was very unpopular. As a matter of fact, I think there was a story, they said, Harry Cohn died. Somebody said, that's one funeral I definitely will be going to. And you had a good comment the other night where, Peter Lorre and Vincent Price went to
Bela Lugosi's funeral.
Bela Lugosi's funeral, and what was it? Peter Lorre said, "Should we drive a stake through his heart,
just to make sure?"
Just to make sure,
But
you know, one thing we've never mentioned—he did serve in World War One. We did kind of mention it yesterday. We didn't mention it tonight, but actually, he was almost completely blind in one eye because of an injury he received in a gas attack during World War One. He had that injury his entire life. That's one thing we never even mentioned about all the acting he did with that. In fact, Adolf Hitler, as a corporal in World War One, also was gassed and almost died, and that's why he was always afraid of the chemical warfare. And he didn't really pursue that himself either. Even his death.
Who was the first person? I'm sorry, Dave. Who was the first person you said?
Claude Rains was blinded.
Oh, Claude Rains. Okay.
Almost completely blinded one eye. And he didn't just memorize his part. He memorized the entire film script. He knew what everybody else was supposed to do as well as himself.
Well, I think part of his early training, his father was a stage actor.
Right. Fred Rains.
Yes. And you mentioned...
When did his father start business? Do you know?
I don't
have a lot on him. I just know that he was born, I think it's November 10th of 1889 in Camberwell, London. And he went to the Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts, where he was recognized by a Sir Herbert Beerbohm Tree, who was the founder of it. He paid for elocution lessons for Claude Rains so he could have extra chance at success as an actor.
He had such a distinctive voice. I know that King has talked about that a couple times. When he used to read bedtime stories to his daughter, and he'd always do it in a Cockney accent. how fun would that have been? Or to have Charles Lawton reading to you. Just think of that.
That would be cool. It's funny you mentioned John Gielgud. He was interviewed after Rains had gone to Hollywood and become a well-known actor. Gielgud commented, "He was a great influence on me. I don't know what happened to him. I think he failed and went to America."
Oh, my. How fun.
Yeah.
Well, why did he go to America? Just more opportunity? Or
Different opportunity. Yeah. I think he really didn't do films there. Like Dale said, we only had one documented film before he came over here. And that was a silent. Was that even here?
No, that was in England, I believe. He played a character named, it was 1920, called Bill Bite House. He played a character named Clarkus.
Yeah,
and,
so it was, it's quite... Quite an extraordinary actor who took on some tr- tremendous roles.
He even did a singing and dancing role in a 1957 TV musical version of The Pied Piper of Hamelin with Van Johnson.
Wow, I didn't catch that anywhere. That would have been interesting. I hope that they had a kinescope of that somewhere.
Yeah,
well, Van Johnson was a big star, wasn't he?
Oh, yeah.
Maybe not at that time, but he became, song, dance. I'm trying to think of his movie roles. I mean, I know he did a lot. I'm pretty sure he did a lot of television.
Yeah. There was, help me out, Dave. It was a kid's movie. It was a cartoon. And Van Johnson, with Cats, I believe, and Van Johnson played one of the voices. What the heck was that? It wasn't a Disney. I don't remember.
I don't remember.
I think he did some. Van Johnson did some radio too, didn't he? Matter of fact, I think he might have had his own show. I could be wrong.
Who?
Van Johnson?
I know he did. He did several suspenses. I don't know what he did. I don't know that he had his own radio show, but he could have. A lot of shows didn't last that long. A lot of times actors agree to do radio programs if they were in between movies.
I know he was on The Big Show, and he did a, it was one of the dramatic pieces they were did, and it was, it had to do with the, excuse me, the Nisei Japanese who actually were in the U.S. Army. They fought on the side of America, but they were, given a hard time by some of the other troops. And this was it's a very interesting piece. About prejudice, matter of fact, Frank Sinatra did, this might have been TV and radio. It's called The House I Live In, and it basically covers anti-Semitism, and that was something that, it's a shame there wasn't more, but you have to sort of understand the times. Those shows were not popular, because people didn't want to be reminded of it, or they shared a differing view. So that was, it took some brave people to kind of say, hey, we have to respect everybody regardless of, this, that, or whatever. And these are topics that, if you go back to, I know there's a source that I finally rediscovered for old radio shows, and they talk about comedians who performed in blackface, and, it was... It was an interesting period, because you had Life of Luigi or the Goldbergs, or any kind of situation where you had people who weren't, were obviously immigrants, and people, they laughed at Luigi. But a lot of people later on took offense at, these shows saying, this guy's obviously an Italian immigrant. It was like there was a commercial, I think, for, it said Spicy Spicy Meatballs or something like that.
Yeah.
And that was that was taken off the air.
Yeah.
Because people objected to that, and you talked about it. We talked about it on the radio show, that pre-Kool-Aid.
Funny Face.
Funny Face. Yeah, where it was...
Yeah, they had problems with that, too, for the ethnic portrayals, just like the Frito Bandito. We got about 5 minutes left here on the live portion of our show. So I again want to thank the live listeners today, Evil Annie, Fogsbane, and guest 808 and 812. We also have others we can't see, and they are like the Invisible Man. Speaking of which, I found an interesting quote here from James Whale, the director. I guess it turns out that Claude Rains flunked his screen test, and he called it the worst screen test in the history of filmmaking. But James Whale hired Rains anyway, stating, "I don't care what he looks like. That's the voice I want."
Yeah. You know, another thing I found interesting, kind of even taking a quick overview of his career in movies and television, is that he really didn't touch television until, I'm looking here, I think it was 1953 was the first time he went into television. And yet he was still able to, and usually once you go into television like that, the actors or actresses are pretty much stuck on television, even if they're made for TV movies and stuff. He was still able to navigate between theater movies and the television programs as well. That was very rare, I think, for back then, that he was able to navigate between the two so easily that when a role would come up, he'd jump on it. If not, he'd look to see what was available to do on television, it seems. Very, very interesting, and it shows to the fact that he was not so pigeonholed into a role like so many actors get.
That's true. You really don't see him doing any one thing.
Yeah, another one I think of kind of like that would be like Bogart. You know, he didn't get locked into anything, even though he started his career playing Dracula on the stage. And so you had all these certain people who just refused to do enough of certain types of roles that they just wouldn't get pigeonholed. And he was one that had enough diversity that he wouldn't allow himself to get caught in a particular vein.
Fred Astaire's original screen test, the guy said something like, well, he can sing and dance a little. That was it. You know, I mean,
well, that music means we're wrapping it up, guys. We can hang out in the bonus time, if you like, for a little while. But I want to thank the live listeners and anybody in the archives. Stick around. We're going to chat a bit longer about Claude Rains and about stuff. Because that's what we do here on Ernie House Radio. And I am here with...
Derek Bickley from the Weirdest Really Bad Movie.
And the King. Not Elvis.
Where can do we have any upcoming viewings of Weirdness Really Bad coming up on the internet?
Monday night on the Vortex, horrorhost.net. We'll be there with Mike Pace movie. I forget which one it is, but we got it. We're on the Vortex Monday night, 9 p.m.
Be there.
When is Gar's show? Yeah, when is Gar's show?
On tonight, but it's not on tonight. Shot me a message. He was ailing, not feeling well, so he canceled his show and couldn't make it here tonight. So, Gar, get better, will you?
Yes.
Where can I find his shows? Do you know? I've looked for him.
I'll send them to you, King.
Oh, okay. Yeah, if you could send me a link.
Or you could go to his Facebook page. He has links for it.
Okay. I looked on YouTube and I really couldn't find a whole lot.
He does a live show. He does not record.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he does a live show. He's a very unique horror host in that he does his thing live.
Brave. He's brave. He's brave.
Yeah. That takes a lot of schmalt, man. All right, folks. Well, live listeners, thanks for coming, and we'll see you next week on Friday night for more Old Time Radio. See ya. Hey. There we go. That is that.
That is that. Well, sure. So Gard guards me into coming in on the show tonight by mentioning my name on a post, and he bails. Thanks, Gar.
Yeah. May your chicken soup burn the roof of your mouth.
I'll tell you what, that's why, I mean, seriously, if I did have a kingdom, he would be the court jester, and he doesn't have to wear the hat or that. Just, you know, someone that's just genuinely funny.
Make him wear the hat.
He's got to wear the hat.
Yeah.
Well,
how can you be a jester without the hat?
It's true.
Well, I don't know if it'd fit on top of his wig.
Get him an extra
line. I mean, yeah. I guess it's hard to say. I mean, I'm kind of new to the king thing. And, considering that, I think probably if you're paying a mortgage, I don't know if you're qualified to be a king. Isn't a kingdom sort of like, it's already there, you got the castle, which I don't.
I imagine there's been kings who have had to pay, like, I don't know, taxes or other, levies of some kind to other kings or other governments. You could still be a king. You're a king to us.
Well, you're kings to me. I mean, you're kings to...
Your home is your castle, your kingdom, so you're all set.
Well, it's let's put it this way, it's my kingdom. Whether or not anybody else really agrees with it or recognizes it, it's still my little 1,121 square feet of kingdom, with my fantastic view from the second floor balcony. To my left is a five-story parking garage, and in front of me is the backside of it. I think it's probably six or seven stories tall. A public storage unit.
Oh, I thought you saw someone's backside.
Can you, getting off track to Claude Rains.
Yes.
Dale, can you possibly tell me, of all the films he did, what would be your favorite one?
I'm leaning heavily towards The Wolfman, probably because it's one of my favorite films. I like the way he portrayed Chaney's father and, was very caring about him and stuff because he thought his son was going a little nutty, claiming he was a werewolf. But I like The Invisible Man in that, and again, his slow meltdown into madness, the way he portrayed that.
And that one, he was the lead, and I really think that the whole film followed him along there. Although you can't complain about what he did in Phantom of the Opera.
Which I'm ashamed to say I don't think I've seen, or if I have, it's long, long time ago on maybe Channel 43, maybe?
Channel 43 played favorites, huh?
I don't think I've seen it. That's one I want to get around to seeing. I haven't seen the Herbert Lahm version either. Since I have Claude Rains on my mind now.
Well, you mentioned a bunch of films. The Adventures of Robin Hood I really like, and I maybe it's old age, but I had forgotten he was in it.
Yeah, because he wasn't always the lead. Some movies he was the lead, and some movies he wasn't, but he was in a heck of a lot of A movies. Whether he was the lead or not, and there's a lot of actors I think that would have turned down being supported actors.
Oh, absolutely. Some with their egos, they're just not going to do it.
Yeah.
I'm looking at this
website.
Well,
they all have agents now, too. You know, I'm sure they did back then. But, I mean, today, you know, an agent for, well, whoever it might be might say, well, that's a step down from where you were. But, you know I've said this before, but suppose you haven't worked in a while, and we talked about a couple of different things, one of which is, hey, I need the money, or number two, you need the exposure because people are starting to forget you. I mean, if you
back then during the studio, when it was run not by bean counters, but by people who knew how to make movies, they had a way of really promoting and killing people's careers sometimes. It was a tough thing, but still better than what you get when you get people that run studios that want to make the third Brady Bunch movie or the fourth Dennis the Menace movie or whatever. How many times have they redone Planet of the Apes? You know, and were they better than what the original was Charlton Heston and Rod Serling's script?
I agree completely. I think there's a lot of movies that they, you know, even though I haven't seen them, I've seen, you get stuff like almost everything now is lots of CGI, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, and to tell you the truth, it's a lot better than it used to be. But if the movie, and this is just my opinion, I saw one of the Harry Potter movies, and I think it was Ian McKellen was in it, and I don't remember the other people in the cast, but there's a sequence of about 20 minutes where you have all these special effects. You know, it's just basically they're escaping from a crumbling castle and all this kind of stuff. You got to jump over rocks and everything, but it's like 20 minutes of basically nothing.
I know, you know, the remake of King Kong that Peter Jackson did, which I like, but I thought the dinosaur stampede was overkill. They just kept going and going and going with the CGI, and it's as much as I love dinosaurs, as much as I love special effects with them, I just thought it was overkill.
Yeah, like they said, what does it add? What does it add to the movie?
Yeah,
you know,
it ran too long. The stampede sequence ran too long. That's why I like using my imagination with radio. I know you two, I'm sure you agree. I'm looking at a website here. It looks like we tapped on it briefly last night, but it looks like he did a lot of radio. He did Ford Theater and Sanctum Mysteries.
Yeah, I think I mentioned most of those last night during a certain point. I think right after the first half, because I think you had asked what other radio had he done because he had such a distinctive voice. And during right after the first half, and got out the Death of Mary Queen of Scots. I got into that really quick. But you know what? He wasn't wrong. They open the door and screams and the dead, you know, and just like you all marry a Queen of Scots, bam! And then there's all that banging and banging and all that kind of stuff. He wasn't wrong on that point. I thought it was hilarious.
I mean, how would you take something like Monty Python and resurrect it today? It would be impossible.
There's a lot of things that would be impossible. You could never do All in the Family again. You could never do...
What a shame. Look what a classic that is, and basically how it shows a little bit of Archie Bunker in all of us many times. That you could never do that again today.
Yeah.
And like Dave said before, how could you possibly, you talked about colorizing it, but I mean, I'm sure at some point some idiot somewhere, just my opinion, will say, let's try the Dick Van Dyke Show. Impossible.
Well,
you could never recreate that cast.
It hurted any, but it didn't add anything to it, you know.
No, but I'm talking about somebody saying, hey, you know, let's remake the Dick Van Dyke Show.
Yeah.
Or, you know, any...
Remake the Van Dyke Show without Dick Van Dyke, so...
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Well,
it's called Dick Van Dyke Show for a reason.
I mean, you wouldn't have Maury Amsterdam or Rosemarie, and I think Mary Tyler Moore. I mean, she was one of the few people after Dick Van Dyke. She had that show called the one where she's the reporter with Lou Grant. Was that the Mary Tyler Moore
show?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that was personally, I thought it was a great show. But she had a lot of shows that did not work. She tried variety shows.
The variety show was okay. It showcased her ability to sing and dance. She was a dancer.
Yeah.
I always enjoyed the moments that she and Dick Van Dyke did musical numbers on the Dick Van Dyke Show.
Oh, yeah.
Because it was so different than anything else, than any other sitcom on television. You know, the only thing I can even think of that did anything like that, Drew Carey's show. Think about it.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
That's the only other sitcom I know that ever just occasionally did something like that and did musical numbers or something like that, was completely out of character for the show even, you know. I thought that would be my closest comparison to it, I think.
Well, the Drew Carey show, I thought, was a real groundbreaker, you know, because it brought a certain kind of, what would you call it? I'm going to call it insanity, you know, but things that you never would have even thought of, you know, or characters that just had sides to them that were just, you know, just, it's like, oh my God, you know, this guy is, you know, it's like this or that or whatever. The scenes in the store, oh, what was the other show that I liked for a while? Murphy Brown? I thought that was another show where, again, it's an ensemble cast. It works so well together.
Candace Bergen, who was daughter of Edgar Bergen, of the Edgar Bergen Charlie McCarthy fame, said she really would have loved her father to have seen that show because she knows that he would have loved it.
He was seriously, that's another one that when I started collecting, you know, found a couple of these shows, and then I searched for every single one that I could find. I mean, his shows, anything that he guest starred on, I mean, it became an obsession just because he was so funny.
He was. And the last televised performance he did was on television's The Big Show, and he made an appearance on that. Eric Idle was on that also, but he made an appearance there, and I think it was about a month after that appearance he passed away. Matter of fact, I think he was supposed to do a show in Cincinnati, and he didn't make it to that show. So, what a great and who would have ever thought that a ventriloquist would work on radio?
Yeah.
That's how believable he made Charlie McCarthy.
That's actually probably good because I understand he was really not the best ventriloquist. You could often see
he always made fun of himself. He always made fun of himself by Charlie saying, "I saw your lips move on that one, Bergen."
Right.
You know.
Well, he wasn't afraid to laugh at himself. And we talked about like Red Skelton if a joke fell flat, you know. He knew how to deal with it, you know, get the audience to, he could still get a laugh out of the audience. I mean, the way Johnny Carson did, just by lifting an eyebrow.
Well, funny thing about Red Skelton, on his radio show, very funny because he was so busy on the movies at that time, that they basically had a little bit of time to rehearse and that was it. And then, you know, because he was doing his movies.
Yeah.
He never had guest stars, almost never had guest stars on the radio show. But his television show was all about the guest star. And that's when you really got to see Red Skelton, because then when something would go wrong or something would happen, or he would just do it, he would improv. He would just he would just go whatever with whatever he felt like sometime. And that was completely different than what he did on radio with first Ozzie Nelson was his first band, and later on it was David Rose, who of course went on to write the song The Stripper.
Yep.
But it was his radio show was completely, and I loved it because, and my favorite part, because he came on almost every show, where he portrayed Junior, the mean little kid. And,
that character was great.
What a great, great character. It really didn't transfer. He did it a few times somewhat on television. It didn't really transfer like it did on radio. Radio, he was believable as the mean little kid. It wasn't as believable. That's why Deadeye became much bigger of his characters and the Willie Lump Lump and his Freddy the Freeloader. Those other characters that he had on radio, the only one that really didn't survive well was Junior, the mean little kid.
Don't forget Gertrude and Heathcliff. Don't forget Gertrude and Heathcliff.
I love those.
Gertrude and Heathcliff. Love that. That was absolutely hilarious. Let me ask you both a question. The Honeymooners. Jackie Gleason, I think, was very famous for not wanting to rehearse. Very little. Sometimes, I think, not even at all. But to me, it never looked that way. I mean, to me, it always looked like, you know, everybody got there. I mean, there was no awkward pauses or anything like that. I mean, sometimes you could see, if you look real close, sometimes you can see Art Carney kind of busting up in the background a little bit. But
Art Carney and Alice got all the great lines, and he didn't care. All he wanted was something to react to. That's all he ever wanted, was something to react to.
It was a genius. I don't know. I'd be curious.
But you had to look at the cast that worked around him as well. If he was doing that, Meadows and Art Carney had to know how to work around it to keep things going in case something slowed down.
He really was a genius. I believe he wrote the Honeymooners theme too, didn't he?
I think he did. I believe you're right.
He wrote this. I didn't know.
Yeah.
He was interesting because, you know, it started off as little sketches, and they call them the Lost Honeymoon episodes.
Yeah.
They were sketches in his variety show, and then they did that for 1 year. I don't know what they were against, but whatever it was, they couldn't beat it. And so the year after that, he went back to his variety show, and he brought those back into sketches. And even when he did the show in the late 60s, when he went down to Miami, he included honeymoon sketches there, and Art Carney right back along with him. So it was he was the great one, I'm telling you.
Yeah. I mean, he earned his name because I think he, and that was, I mean, that was so odd that, you know, that this fantastic show, 1 year? But then again, I mean, if they were giving him other opportunities, you know, maybe he liked the idea of a variety show better. I mean, I don't know. One of the things I would like to do is read a biography or, I don't know, I doubt if he wrote an autobiography, but I would love to see a biography of him.
I think it was interesting because, you know, every time his career really seemed to start to slow down and take a dip, I mean, very adept at dramatic acting. Just look what he did in when Rod Serling took his Requiem for a Heavyweight that he wrote for Playhouse 90 and put it into a movie version with Anthony Quinn and Mickey Rooney.
Yeah.
And Gleason was just absolutely unbelievable in what he did.
I loved him in The Hustler. He played a very dramatic piece in there. It's not what you expected for used to the Honeymooners.
Every time his career went down, like when his show, he lost like 40 pounds or so in the last season, and they said that was one of the reasons they didn't think he was as funny when he was thinner. And he, so basically that was one of the reasons his show got canceled. And it was not long after that that, guess what, Smokey and the Bandit came along, and he was reborn again. And
Sheriff Buford T. Justice.
And if you guys have never gotten a chance to see the last film he did, Nothing in Common with him and Tom Hanks,
Good film.
You'll get to see why he was the great one.
Good film. I like that. I went into it saying, it came on, what was it, Showtime or Cinemax back when I had them. And I thought, nah, Tom Hanks and him, forget it. And I watched it, and the next time it was on, I watched it again.
Yeah,
because it was so good.
And I tell you what, if you had a farewell film, that would be a good one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was, I absolutely agree. That was a great film. I was surprised.
Because it wasn't much variety or attention or anything. And maybe it was because Gleason was in it. I don't know. But I thought
it was understated, too.
It was understated.
The movie, Tom Hanks was, he wasn't the bosom buddy guy, and
right.
Jackie Gleason wasn't, the slow burn, and then retort to Alice or Carney. I thought that was one of the brilliant things about the show, or about the movie, was that it was understated, that they didn't go for the easy tear-jerking scene. They didn't go, they made it real. They made it so, just kind of human, that the actors could be, just real people.
Yeah. And I'm looking at the rest of the cast outside of Eva Marie Saint. There weren't any real heavies in this movie.
That just because you have this, a stellar cast, you got this person, this person, this person, this person, that doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be a great movie because, some of the stars, that they tap, I don't know in the past 10 years because I don't watch hardly anything in color anymore, but, I shy away from anything where you have, 15 different stars or, supposed stars or whatever like that, because they're not going to get nobody's going to get a whole lot of time in it. And,
With one exception, it's a mad, 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 mad world.
Well, yeah. Oh, jeez, that was hilarious.
Yeah.
Oh, jeez. Milton Berle was in that, wasn't he?
Everybody was
Milton
in
Berle,
it.
Milton Berle, Buddy Hackett, Jimmy Durante, Jonathan Winters.
Yeah.
Max
Stooges.
Bear Jr. Buster
Keaton was in that.
Ethel Merman. Phil Silvers. And I was not a big fan of Phil Silvers, but I enjoyed him a lot in that. I always thought that Sergeant Bilko was so overrated. But I've seen some things. It was one of the, he was very, very good in. Mickey Rooney. Three Stooges had a cameo. Jack Benny had a cameo.
Buster Keaton was in that, wasn't he?
Buster Keaton was in that, yes.
Yeah.
Stan Freberg was in it. His part got cut on the... He was also in the police department where Buster Keaton was, and his part got cut out. Buddy Hackett, Kramer had never done comedy before, and he assembled some of the greatest comedic talents ever assembled to do this, and he just had absolutely no control over anything that happened in that entire film. But it was great.
You gotta figure
it really was.
I mean, I would love to have seen the production of that film. If they had outtakes or bloopers or anything like
behind
that.
Behind the scenes,
behind the scenes. BTS. Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
I would love to have seen that.
Well, they always say the backstage show is always better because that's where you cut loose and and have good times. I think that's why sometimes this bonus time is so much fun that we're rapidly coming to the end of. Because we, you know what I mean? We're not as bound to sticking to the topic of Claude Rains. We keep steering that way because the show is about him. But we get to wander off and talk about these things that these threads of conversation are amazing.
Yeah.
how our memories are stimulated, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Because, I mean, I tell you what, every time that I listen to, you know, us together, I learn something, you know? I mean,
everybody brings something to the table, and I think that's a really cool thing.
Yeah, it is. And
I mean, it gives me it gives me, you know, somebody mentions a movie, and I think, I've never even seen that before.
I know, then you feel compelled, I got to see this. Well, we'll be back on Friday with the most famous man in the world, a mysterious traveler episode.
Mysterious traveler.
And that'll be Friday at 7:30.
Where the trip may thrill you a little and chill you a little.
I'm looking forward
we'll be here
to it.
We'll be here to walk everybody through it, you know.
Well, you promised
we'll be like William Castle. We'll get an insurance policy if you die of fright during the show. Why?
Payable to us.
Gar will do your eulogy.
I think we should get the We should get the seat buzzers that William Castle used to put in for the Tingler.
Yes, I used to tell my kids it was filmed in Buttovision. Because you were going to get zapped in the behind.
I think also, didn't John Waters do a film where it was a scratch and sniff card? I'm trying to think of the name of it.
God, I hope it wasn't porn.
No. It wasn't one of his early films. It was a later film, but it was... it was originally, it was kind of after the fact that they came. Well, I think when they re-released it or when it came out on.
There was something, though. I do remember that, King. And I can't remember what film it was, but it.
Yeah.
You know, they were still trying to. That was maybe the 60s or even the 70s. They were still trying to do gimmicks to get you into the theater.
Yeah. I mean, somebody came out with. What was it? Smell-o-vision?
And you had your, they had this, you know, stomach distress bags for some films.
And I thought about that. I thought, well, if you have a Western, well, I was going to say, you probably have a lot of cows in it and horses. I'm not sure I really want to,
Yeah, they can wait before they develop smell-o-vision. That's especially Westerns.
Or say an action film. Are you going to smell a lot of people sweating? I don't want. I don't think I want to do that.
No. Or any films that take place during the Dark Ages. People didn't bathe very much.
Yeah.
You know, and you couldn't watch the television show Emergency, you know, because all the smoke, you know, come on.
Yeah.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I was a couple of years ago, I was reading a book about the French Revolution way back, and they said that whoever was the Louis the 14th or 13th, whatever it was, he never took a bath. And
there was a period when they thought taking a bath was unhealthy, actually.
Yeah.
And
so
that was pretty dumb.
Him with perfume.
Okay, I thought of the worst film for smell-o-vision.
Okay.
Blazing Saddles.
Yep. at least that one scene, yeah.
Yes.
But yeah, that was only one scene there, but what about the Attack of the Killer Tomatoes?
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, that would do it. Yeah. Didn't they remake that?
Well, they had a sequel movie. There was
a
two.
I've seen them both. Yeah. The first one was okay. Second one, not quite so much.
Yeah.
Kind of like Airplane and Airplane 2, the sequel. You know, that doesn't quite measure up.
Which one?
Airplane and Airplane 2, the sequel. Even though I thought William Shatner spoofing his role was hilarious. That was
funny. That part was good, but overall it wasn't anywhere near as good as Airplane 1.
Well, it's because they took it away from the Zucker brothers.
Yeah.
They said they wouldn't do it, so the studio did it anyway. And
those
that's what
dirty
you got.
Zuckers. Those dirty Zuckers.
Yeah.
Oh, what was her name? Leave It to Beaver's mom.
She was in the original one. Yeah, she was in the original. I understand it. I speak jive.
Yeah.
well, there again is more humor you can't do today.
Yeah.
Because
you see the more recent one, 1,000 Ways to Die in the West or the Old West.
No.
Yeah, that's a movie I swore they couldn't do today, but they did.
Huh.
What was that?
Just like a couple of years old, Seth MacFarlane movie. He wrote and directed it and starred in it. And Liam Neeson was the bad guy in there. And it's another one of those films that I didn't think you could make today, and they did.
Wow. Well, with that happy thought, guys.
They did a remake of The Three Stooges. I have not seen the entire film, but I have seen parts of it.
I've seen it. It's not horrible, but it's not The Stooges, really.
No.
It's a good homage, but don't do any more, please.
Yeah. They tried hard. The actors tried hard, but you can't. Who could be Curly? You know?
What's his name? Will Sasso did a pretty good job. He did a pretty good job. The fellow that got
He's
the
not
play Moe
was
amazing.
He's not going to forget Curly Howard. Or Horvitz actually was the family name.
Right. And the guy who played Moe was amazing.
Oh, he was. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I thought he was
very good.
And actually, the guy that played Larry was not bad. And I was trying to think who the name of that guy was.
Carrot Top,
you know,
I think.
Pardon? I don't know.
Carrot Top, I think.
Oh, geez, don't remind me, because I actually sat through that movie. and it's like, well, there's an hour and a half of my life. Boy, I wish I could get that back.
Yeah. Well, guys, we're going to have to wrap it up here. We'll see you Friday night at 7:30.
All right. Feel better, Gar, and Dale, feel better.
I will try. I'm going to take a bath in Vicks. I'm going to fill the bathtub with Vicks VapoRub and jump in.
All right, sir. Have a very good one.
I'll feel tingly all over. Oh, jeez.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for letting me participate.
Oh, absolutely. You're always welcome in Erie House. So are you, folks. You can always call in during the live portion of our show at 646-378-0264. Thanks for listening this long. And thank you, gentlemen. We'll see you Friday night here on Erie House Radio. Bye-bye.
Bye.